All-age worship. Put your hands up if you've ever been part of an all-age worship experience in church, and it's been an absolutely horrendous experience. Now, I can put my hand up because on most of those occasions, it was me that was leading it, okay? But I just wonder if you've had, if the scenario I'm about to paint rings any bells of familiarity with you at all. That sign of thing, you know, where they start off by saying something like, okay, I want you to turn to the person next to you and exchange underpants or something like that, you know. You immediately know this ain't going to be a good one. So I want you to imagine that you're there, it's Sunday morning, it's all age worship, and you look around the church, and there's actually quite a few young people there in the congregation, a few very young children. That's fantastic. You're really pleased to see them. Some of them are sitting next to their parents or on their laps, and they're generally getting on with whatever's being given them to keep them occupied, such as toys, colouring books, all those little tiny boxes of raisins, the contents of which somehow make their way into all four corners of the car, the house, everywhere. And during the would-be quieter moments of the service, some of the parents who are there look somewhat less than relaxed as they pull out one item after another to try frantically to keep their children from wriggling or making too much noise. Not all of the children there, however, are wriggling. Two toddlers, you know, just having races up and down the aisles of the church. And that's something that continues about halfway through the Old Testament reading until suddenly they become stationary. In other words, they engage in a head-on collision. The few moments of silence are broken when the volume is replaced by a piercing shriek of uncontrollable crying. Two parents frantically make their way to the rescue, and they negotiate their way along the pew. Everybody else is—it's a church that's still got pews in it, and everyone's sat there. And of course, they're pewed right in on the edge, and everyone else there turns like this to try and let them out. And they're kind of doing this kind of manoeuvre thing, and it seems to take about a quarter of an hour to get themselves from pew to aisle. And everybody eventually has to actually get out. It's like that scene of, at the cinema when latecomers arrive. And everyone in the end, it's just easy for everyone just to get up, go out and let them in. But some of the members of the congregation there are kind of glaring over with that look on their faces of disdain that is generally reserved for the experience of discovering a slug in a side salad. So people there aren't looking very happy, and you can almost hear people saying, "What's that? It never used to happen." Eventually, the whole congregation is invited to stand up, and not to let the parents out of the pew, but to invite everyone to join in a selection of action songs. Oh dear. The music group strikes up. About half the people gathered join in, mainly the younger children and their parents, and some of the adults who are there, not with young children of their own, but they're delighted that there are so many young children there in church on this particular morning. However, looking around, there are quite a few people who actually look quite awkward and uncomfortable and aren't quite sure what to do with themselves. One such group is the teenagers. There's about 15 of them. Again, it's fantastic that they're there in church on a Sunday morning. Few of the older ones are quite outgoing, and they leap to the front to help demonstrate some of the actions to the songs. But most of the younger teenagers there, in all honesty, are cringing. They feel like they're being treated as children, and they don't regard themselves as children, even though it wasn't that long ago that they were. And right now, they're actually absorbed in the classic teenage crisis of finding an identity in the process of coming of age. As part of this process, these young people are genuinely interested in questions related to God and to spirituality and to faith. And some of them have already made conscious commitments to Christ. It should therefore be pointed out that they do have a genuine desire to be there in church on this particular morning, not least because they've got a peer group there. But at this particular service, they do feel somewhat out of place and wonder how they fit in. Also in the congregation, there are a number of adults in their 20s and 30s, both singles and couples, but they're without children. They're in church in the same way that they would be on any Sunday morning, but this particular week they're feeling a bit awkward. In a similar way that the teenagers dislike the feeling, that they are being regarded as children, some of these young adults sense an unspoken assumption that they belong to the same demographic group as young parents. It's not where they are, and as such, they feel out of place. And it doesn't help that a lot of people refer to that service as the family service. The church has a large number of men and women over the age of 60, some of whom are in their early 90s. And on the whole, most of them are absolutely overjoyed to see so many young people present in church. However, as the service progresses through a series of action songs, various prayers and readings are set against an increasing caterwauling of restless toddlers, and a 15-minute sermon, which includes a selection of household items which the minister is using as visual aids. Jesus is a bit like this toothbrush. Some of these older people feel more like spectators at a Sunday school outing than members of a worshipping congregation. Parents with children that are there range in age quite widely, from their mid-20s through to their late 40s. In some ways, it might be assumed that of all the adults present, these are the ones that it's going to engage most, because it gives them that opportunity to worship alongside their children. But step inside the hearts and minds of these people for a few moments and consider the sort of issues they're dealing with throughout their everyday lives. These are people whose daily experience is of bringing up children and carrying responsibility for them as well as for themselves. Work and finance and domesticity and schooling, balancing a whole host of time commitments. That's the context in which they're trying to live out and work out what it is to be a Christian today. The extent to which they are being helped to do this by being present in this morning's service is dubious. They may well appreciate the provision of a service in which they can be together with their children, but how much does the experience really provide for their own personal spiritual needs? So all-age worship, okay, there's a bit of an exaggeration there, and I do that on purpose, but all-age worship, and what I mean by that is that experience of when churches gather with all ages together, all ages, and they're there for the whole duration of that service. Can it work? Does it work? Well, very often it goes horribly wrong, and it has been said that it goes wrong when it's one of two things. Either, essentially, it's a service that's been geared up for children at which adults just happen to be present. Or, on the other hand, the other extreme, it's a service that's essentially geared up for adults at which children just happen to be present. And so it's little wonder that somebody once famously defined all-age worship as worship with something to offend everyone. Ministry of the church is, we're actually kind of caught, I think, in a sense, in that place of tension of trying to serve the needs of different generations. And let's be honest, each generation does have different needs. The tension is something that often people, and again, we're talking quite a broad age range here, but often adults between, it can be anything really, between early 30s and early 60s, I guess. But people within that fairly broad age demographic can nevertheless feel pulled in different directions. On the one hand, they can have that growing sense of concern for supporting their children through their education and looking ahead towards full-time education and trying to provide for them and to fund that. At the same time, their parents may be elderly, and they may have that sense of ongoing responsibility towards supporting them, and through all kinds of ways, including nursing care. And sometimes, and we're talking about an increasingly bigger slice of our population in Britain today, I think, a lot of people find themselves in that point of tension where they're trying to meet the needs of both their children and their aging parents. I remember Jasper Carrot. Do you remember him? Jasper Carrot, I don't know what's happened to him. I haven't seen him for years and years and years. But Jasper Carrot, I can remember once, said that he had his teenage children and his mother in her 80s living with him at the same time in the same house. And he said that actually they had a lot in common. He said both his 15-year-old daughter and his 80-something mum insisted on dyeing their hair purple. He said he spent most of his life shouting at both of them to turn the volume down on the telly or the radio. And he said that he was always telling off his 13-year-old son for sliding down the banister. Meanwhile, he's had to fork out 3,000 quid to pay for a chair that will slide his mum up it. So we're in that place of tension where there are real needs across the generations. And for a lot of people, that's the reality in daily life, in domestic life. And as churches, if we are serious about being a church for everyone, for all ages, not just a select few, then actually we can find ourselves in that point of tension. Is it worth the effort? Yes, I think it is. I believe it is. I don't believe that all-age worship, in other words, you know, for a congregation to be gathered for all of its worship time to be spent together, I don't think that that's necessarily the right thing every single week. And it's down to the local church to actually find ways of how it does that. But what I think is far more significant is rather, in terms of the question, you know, what is it to do all-age worship? Well, I think it's more important that we're driven by the question, how can we aspire to be an all-age church well? Because if we can properly and adequately address that question, then all-age worship, I think, will take care of itself. Let me share with you just a little bit about my own background. I was a youth worker originally, and then I became a minister. During my time as when I was training for the ministry, I did a PhD in practical theology. And all of that time, I found myself involved in all-age worship. And over the last 20-odd years now, I've been doing a lot of work in both primary and secondary schools, taking assemblies, RE lessons. And I guess it was over the last few years that I found myself working in both school environments as well as in churches, and also trying to work out the theology of all of this, that I kind of really wanted to have a sense of what is it that makes the difference. And I'm not saying that I do get it right, because I don't, but what is it that in theory actually makes a difference between all-age worship working well and not working well. I had a sabbatical five years ago now, and it gave me the opportunity to do the research on this question of all-age worship. And I looked at two different things. On the one hand, I looked at the theology of what it is to keep growing throughout our whole lives as Christians, not just as children, but as adults. And the other thing that I looked at was the psychology of how we process images in worship. I began by talking about images, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And eventually, I wrote a book which was called Growing Through the Church, the idea being that actually as disciples of Jesus, we're all, whatever age we are, about the business of growth, growing, however old or however young we are. The exciting, amazing thing about, one of the many amazing things about being a Christian is that as long as we're in this world, there's even more there. The best is yet to come in eternity, but God wants us to grow lifelong throughout our discipleship. And so eventually, the book Growing Through the Church looked at that, looked at what it means as with discipleship as its basis, but looked at some of the theory of what's known as faith development and how the imagination operates, and I'll say a bit more about this in a moment, and sets out some of the practical things that we can consider when working with all ages, not just with children and young people in mind, but obviously especially with them in mind, but in a way that enables us to engage with the imaginations of all ages when we're together worshipping in the same place. The book, as I say, I have got some with me. It's normally $11.99. The publishers are very kind, and they let me have them for events like this at a discount, which I'm able to sell them for £10. I'm not here to do the hard sell, the hard push, but I do have a few copies with me, and I'll be around in between the sessions if you would like to buy one. But the image of all age worship is sadly often one that is met with a sense of suspicion, a sense of concern, perhaps because of some unfortunate experiences that people have had in the past, as I said. But I really believe that this is something that we need to, a challenge, a real challenge that we need to face up to. And the reason being is that churches surely are called to be cross-generational communities. It is right that we should be giving a particular emphasis, I believe, in our ministry in trying to reach the unchurched generations. And that will immediately, the first thing we think of is younger people. But let's not kid ourselves. We're not just talking about young people in isolation from the other generations. And it is a much more biblical model for us to be thinking about the questions and processes those questions. How can we reach and engage young people in a way that actually considers, well, how do we build them up and enable them to grow within the wider cross-generational community that we call the church? In a number of years, there has been a lot of experiments with church and a lot of projects that you don't hear the term so much these days, but not that long ago, you heard people often refer to a youth church, the idea, or youth congregations. And there's some fantastic work that's been done, and please don't misunderstand me. I wouldn't for one second want to diss any of that work, because there's been some amazing work that's been done with young people. But the problem, or rather, shall I say, the danger, the potential problem with the concept of a youth congregation, a youth church, is that eventually everyone grows out of it, because nobody stays young forever. And therefore, we have to ask ourselves the question, whatever we're doing with children and young people, we have to have in mind, what are we doing in terms of the context of the church in the wider sense, the multi-generational community? In today's fragmented Western society, I think there's something prophetic about being countercultural here, where in today's society, everything is marketed towards different age-specific groups. The church may perhaps even be one of the, if not the, last remaining community that is a truly, if we're doing it properly and being it properly, that is a truly cross-generational community where people of different ages are brought together. I think it's a bit like, if I can use the word family, I've mentioned that can be a dangerous word to use if it's ever used in an exclusive sense. But if you think of what a family is, and okay, families come in all different shapes and sizes, but if you imagine family as a range of different ages, different generations, there are times within family life when the different ages need to be able to have that time and space to go off and do their own thing. Children need to be able to have their own time on their own doing their own thing, as do the grown-ups. But likewise, it's really important that the family has those times, whether it's around the meal table, whether it's going out for walks, whatever it may be, when it's right for that family to properly bond as a family, to grow as a family, to actually have that time when they're together. And I would say that in the same way, when it comes to church life, yes, it is right. There are times when we need to do things that are age specific, when young people need their own specific time together, when there are things like children's groups, youth groups, and Bible studies for the adults. But it is equally important that we have that time when we're all together so that we can truly grow as an all-age community. Let me read to you something that came from a book published by the Church of England a few years ago called Children in the Way. And I think it's a beautiful picture. It puts it so well. Imagine a group of people of all ages going for a long walk together. At times, the children and adults will walk along together, talking as they go, sharing stories with first one person and then another, each observing different things and sharing their discoveries. At times, the children will lag behind, and some of the adults will have to wait for them to or urge them on. Sometimes, the smallest children may ask to be carried. At other times, though, the children will dash ahead making new discoveries and may perhaps pull the adults along to see what they have found. Some adults may well behave like these children, of course. For all, there will be times of progress and times of rest and refreshment, time to admire the view and times of plodding on, and the eventual satisfaction of arrival at their destination. We're going to think over these two sessions a bit more about all-age worship and how we can work with the imagination. This first session, because it's the first one, I thought our minds are relatively fresh, hopefully. And so the next bit is going to be a bit heavy going, but ride it out. Bear the pain with me, okay? because this is really important in terms of if we want to take seriously the way in which we grow and the way in which the imagination can be used in all-age worship and engaging people of different ages and stages, then this theory which I'm about to share with you is something that I found really, really helpful. I can't go into anything like as much detail this morning as my book goes into, but what I want to do is just share with you a snapshot of something that is known as faith development theory. Now, during the 1970s and the 1980s, there were a number of different psychologists, developmental psychologists, who set out various theories looking at how faith can develop in us in terms of human psychology. And the one that I'm going to share with you this morning, and it became the most, I guess, the most famous one, was one that was put together by somebody called James Fowler, who is a Christian and is a professor of psychology in America in a theological seminary. As I share this with you, I want to say two things. Firstly, bear with me if this feels quite intense, okay, because the second session is going to be much more practical, stuff that you can actually do and use in all-age worship. But it's kind of underpinned by what I'm about to share with you here. The second thing I want to say to you is that as you're listening to what I'm about to share with you, you might be thinking, oh, I'm not sure I totally agree with that. Let me say to you, I don't totally agree with all of this, but I find it a really useful analytical tool, so to speak. Sometimes these things can be really helpful at helping us to understand more about human beings and the way in which we operate. We don't necessarily need to agree with everything that is said in the theory in order to understand its value. Are you with me? Yeah. So what I'm going to share with you is James Fowler's model of faith development. This is how he says, in terms of psychology, faith develops in human beings. And what I'm going to do is paraphrase his stages. He said that there were seven stages. Well, actually, he said there were six stages, but the first stage he calls stage zero. So perhaps if we could have the first one up. Stage zero, and then it goes zero, one, two, three, four, five, six. So seven stages, if you like, or stages zero to six. And what he said was with these stages of faith, they're stages of what he called structural development in psychology. And he says that these stages, because we're talking psychology and not theology here, and there's a distinction which I personally struggle with, but nevertheless, there is he draws the distinction and says that because we're talking about purely psychological terms, these stages can apply to any faith, including atheism. And often people say, well, atheism, that's not a faith, is it? Yes, it is. Because atheism, of course, is the faith that there is no God. And I think that takes a huge amount of faith to actually live by that conviction that there is no God. So Fowler's contention is that these different these different psychological patterns, these stages, exist regardless of what your own faith content happens to be, not just Christianity. So the first one, he refers to, he calls it primal faith, which is a kind of pre-stage, hence it's called stage zero. I prefer the word trust there. But during that stage of trust, that's when an infant learns the basics of how to trust or not. It's very much rooted in the relationship that the child has with the mother or the mother figure. And during those very early stages of life, we learn those basics of intimacy in human relationships. And we learn the dynamics of how to experience trust and to live by trust, or if it goes wrong, not to live by trust. The second stage, which is actually number one here, I know it's obviously confusing. I'll just refer to it as stage one. Is impressionistic faith. Fowler calls it intuitive projective, but I prefer the word impressionistic, basically because at this stage, faith is all about processing the impressions that we pick up. It refers to the preschool years, so up to about 5 years old. And when we're up at that age, during the preschool years, we absorb impressions, we absorb images. But at this stage, we can't process them because we haven't actually developed psychologically enough to do so. So what that means is that to a preschooler, you can absorb impressions, but you can't actually separate fantasy from reality. There's no concept of something being fictional necessarily. Life is one innocent, seamless world of stories and experiences and imagery. So during this time, it's about impressions. Impressions are made on us, but we haven't yet learned how to actually process those impressions psychologically. The next stage, stage two, we can call literalist faith. And this refers to what goes on from about, and it's different across human beings, but generally speaking, from around 6 years of age. During this stage, the literalist stage, or the mythic stroke literal stage, as Fowler calls it, it's a stage when children absolutely love story. You're probably familiar with that with children at that age, that they just live and breathe story. They love to hear stories. They love to tell stories. They love stories. But when they hear stories at that age, and they find it for the love of story, they can only take it literally. So in other words, they can't yet stand back from it and interpret and analyze contrasting perspectives within a story. They have a concrete understanding, but only a concrete understanding of story. So in other words, they can't think in terms of abstract thoughts at this stage. Abstract thinking comes later on, but at this stage, everything is literal. Now, the next stage, stage three, is called owned faith. Now, the fascinating thing here is that although Fowler talks about links this to child development, human development, he says it's not necessarily linked to our age. So in other words, we can say roughly the age that we might expect to move through these stages. However, Fowler says that a lot of adults don't necessarily pass through all of those stages. And this is where it gets, I think, really interesting. But as we go through our lives, and as we go through our lives as Christians, we may notice in ourselves and possibly in others around us some of these different patterns. You see, the owned faith stage, again, in human terms, generally encountered around adolescence, but it could be earlier, it could be later. But Fowler talks of owned faith, he talks of, uses the phrase synthetic conventional, but owned says more what it is on the inside the tin, if you like, which is why I prefer the phrase. But basically, owned faith refers to that stage when we start to have that ability to think in terms of abstract concepts. So in other words, we can distinguish between fact and fiction. We can understand what is mythological and what is actually factual, historical. We can make those kind of distinctions. We can begin to understand the difference between symbol and something that isn't a symbol. We can process images more. But the reason he calls it, the reason I've used suggest the word owned faith to describe it as a faith stage, is that it's at that stage where we begin psychologically to be able to do abstract thinking. It's at that stage that we begin to actually make our own faith commitments. We decide for ourselves what we believe in. Because we're able to think more for ourselves and to make the distinctions between things that are literal and not literal, it's at that point that we begin to become psychologically advanced enough to be able to say, okay, I can sift out these different range of choices, and that's the one I'm going to go for. Having looked at all the different choices, Christianity is the one I'm going to go for. Therefore, I am a Christian. I become a Christian. Yeah. So it's about owning faith. It's about making a decision, making a choice for yourself. And remember that Fowler says that this doesn't just apply to Christianity, but in terms of our context, that's what we're talking about. So it's at that stage that actually faith can become something that we actually own a personal choice over in a more sort of meaningful way. However, and it's a big however, Fowler says that at this stage, even though beliefs and values and commitments can be owned personally as we make a commitment, they're not necessarily given a lot of critical analysis in significant depth. In other words, truth is accepted on the basis of some kind of external authority. Now, what he means by that is that somebody will say, yes, I own this decision now to, for our purposes, to be a Christian. However, the basis on which they do it is based on what somebody else has said to them. So in other words, I choose to believe this because the Bible tells me that. Or I choose to believe this because I heard the preacher say this. I choose to believe this because my pastor or my minister has said this. Or I choose to believe this because my youth leader has led me to believe this. It may not, again, necessarily apply just to Christians. And to give an example, this is where the atheist, an example of this in atheism, an atheist might say, yeah, I don't believe in God. And you say to them, well, why don't you believe in God? Well, I don't believe in God because I read this book that Dawkins wrote. Or I don't believe in God because some bloke on Channel 4 the other night was saying, or I don't believe in God because everybody else I know says, and what's the evidence there? In other words, there's a sense in which there is an owned commitment at this stage, but the ownership of that commitment is actually essentially driven by the authority of others around the individual rather than the individual themselves. In other words, the ability to actually take root in a very personal way in which the choice itself has been very critically evaluated hasn't yet been reached. So that's what's called owned faith. Now, interestingly, Fowler, and here you may choose to agree or disagree, Fowler reckons that a majority of church people actually stay at that stage throughout our lives. May be true, may not be true, but it's an interesting thought. But the next stage is what's called stage four, critical faith. Fowler calls it individuative reflective. I prefer critical. He says that this can, again, we're talking general terms, but this can often emerge in young adulthood. It might be at a time of a particular crisis. It might be when somebody's just left home, perhaps if they've left home to go to university or moved away from parents. It might happen when somebody's starting out home, a sense of finding their own feet in the world as a young adult. It can happen a little bit later on. Bereavement can be something that can trigger it off. But basically, it's at this stage, whatever the trigger may be, that, as the word suggests, that critical thinking develops. And it's at this point when we actually start to really question, well, okay, I believe that, or thought I did up until now, but why do I believe that? Well, what's that about? And perhaps sometimes this can be regarded in negative terms. And Fowler, and indeed others, and I think this is what I find really challenging as a church leader, as a pastor, is that sometimes that stage is suggested is perhaps regarded as one of losing faith. Whereas actually, perhaps we might not choose to look at it in those terms. Actually, questioning faith doesn't necessarily mean losing faith. It just means that we're questioning it, we're exploring it, we're trying to plumb greater depths. But a lot of stuff has been written by people to suggest that actually sometimes people find themselves at that stage in their development, find themselves, or they perceive themselves, to be unsupported within the churches, because the moment they start to articulate those questions about their faith, they sense that they're being told, well, actually, it's not right to ask these questions. You should just believe and have faith. And as such, they felt that questioning instinct isn't welcome within church, and they leave. Now, again, I don't know whether that is necessarily true, but there's something there that I think rings with familiarity in some aspects of human experience. And it's often here that people give up on church with the perception that church is not somewhere where they can rigorously ask questions. Now, as I say, I think if we're doing Christian spirituality properly, the gospel is big enough and robust enough to stand up to that questioning. But culturally, perhaps we need to ask ourselves a lot of questions when we hear stories of people leaving churches or giving up on church because of those perceptions. One thing that Fowler does say about this faith stage is that it's very individualistic. In other words, it can, in its most extreme form, be a place where the individual is just lost in their own questions and immersed in their own questions, and only ever stays with the questions and may not actually ever be kind of, at that stage, be content with any answers at all. And it becomes very, very isolating and very individualistic. But fifth stage of development, or rather stage number five, is what we could call renewed or integrated faith. It's hard to define this one, but it's basically where if somebody's got to create stage four, critical faith, and they've been immersed in their questions and asking questions, questioning, hit the point where actually they realise that you can stay in that place forever, but it's actually not that helpful. And there comes a point where you actually got to make some kind of decisions. And yes, it may be that questioning's healthy, but if you only ever stay with the questions and never entertain the possibilities that there just might be some answers, then you don't actually move on or grow. And it's where the critical evaluation stage of stage four discovers a fresh, renewed sense of humility and aware that actually, as human beings, there's very little that we know, and that it's okay to have outstanding questions, that faith actually doesn't mean to say we've got to have it all neatly stitched up, and we can therefore live with those grey areas. And as such, somebody, Fowler says, at stage five is somebody who discovers that in a new and a fresh way. They come back to the faith that they discovered earlier on in their journey, but they discover it in a new depth, in a way that enables them to be able to say, actually, I'm okay with this. There are things that I don't know the answers to, and I don't think I will this side of eternity, but that's okay, because I trust in God. God is bigger than my questions. The next stage, the last stage, stage six, is what Fowler can call it absolute faith, or he calls it universalizing faith. He says that, in fact, he thinks very few people reach this stage. He says it's perhaps more of an ideal than a reality, but he says that's when you reach absolute faith is when you move through all of those and actually you sense that ultimate authority is totally, totally in God, and there's an absolute decentering of the self. And Fowler talks of how perhaps that's really just an extension of stage five. So that's the theory stuff. It's a fascinating stuff to look at. As I say, in my book, I go into a lot more depth and analysis over those stages. I find them helpful as a piece of analysis. You may have mixed feelings about stage theories. You've probably come across stage theories before human development. You've probably heard this one, that actually there are four stages of life, not seven. The first stage of life is actually you believe in Father Christmas. The second stage is you don't believe in Father Christmas. The third stage is you are Father Christmas. The fourth stage is you look like Father Christmas. Or there's another one that the way in which success is defined. At the age of 4 years old, success is not piddling in your pants. At the age of 12, success is having friends. At the age of 17, success is having a driver's license. At age 35, success is having money. At age 50, success is having money. At age 70, success is still having a driver's license. At age 75, success is having friends. At age 80, success is not piddling in your pants. Now, there are various different ideas around about what it means to live and to grow as human beings. Now, I would want to say that whether we accept what Fowler says about faith development or not, and there's a lot of criticism that can be made, it does help us to understand the diversity of what we could call developmental processes that are there, so developmental presences that are there in any gathering of people, any congregation, regardless of age. And what I want to suggest to you is that regardless of the ages that are present in a church gathering, any gathering for that matter, but in any kind of, use the word congregation, that there will be people of different developmental stages there, regardless of their ages. So it could even be a gathering of entirely adults, but there'll be different stages in development there. And the challenge, therefore, I believe, is that when we're trying to engage with people, if we forget about age for a moment and just think about stages and stages of development, if we can engage with people's stages of human development, then our engagement with different age groups that happen to be present will simply take care of itself, if that makes any sense. And I think it is possible to do. Can I have a volunteer? Someone feeling really brave. Shall I show you what? Let me show you something first, and then I'll ask a volunteer, and then you'll be even more put off. I've got here a guillotine. It's not a big guillotine, you can't quite stick your head through it, but you can put a piece of carrot through it. And if I put that through there, just to give you an idea of just how sharp this is, if I bring the blade down, one, two, three, you can see it's pretty sharp. Now, can I have a volunteer? Oh, you've rushed up, wow. Thank you very much. What's your name?
Gracie.
Gracie, I should have just got it there on your sticker. Okay, Gracie, have you done this before? Didn't think so. Okay, this is, so you can't fit a head through there, but you can just about fit a finger in there. Would you like just to place your finger in there?
No.
I thought you would. Give her a round of applause and some encouragement. Yes. Okay, trust me. Trust me, I'm a vicar. We're going to count down from three, okay, and the blade will come down. So, one, two, but before we do, there's an important part to this trick. I have here a smaller piece of carrot. You'll notice that beneath that hole there is a really small hole, and I'm going to thread the piece of carrot through that hole. And here's the amazing thing about this, because although the carrot below shall be cleft in twain, your finger shall be whole. Absolutely. Okay, so finger through hole. And one, two. Hang on, do you want to just scratch your nose with it? With your finger? Yeah, yeah. Just it might be the last time you get to do it. Okay.
Oh,
finger through hole. Okay. Three, two. Well, hang on. Could you just put your other hand out and hold that underneath? Oh, sorry, that was... Sorry, this was just where the last time I did it, but it that doesn't normally happen, so don't worry. Okay, we got finger. We've got guillotine, we've got carrot, we've got cup. Okay, Gracie.
Shall I do that?
Put your finger through the hole. How are you feeling right now? How are you feeling right now? Gracie, seriously, how are you feeling right now?
Nervous.
Nervous? You know, the thing is we all get nervous at times. We all get anxious at times. We get worried at times. And the amazing thing is, even though we feel totally out of our depth in those places, like you might right now, God's with us because he's bigger than all of our fears.
Really?
Yeah. 3, 2, 1, 4, 5, 6. And there we go. A round of applause for Gracie. Thank you, Gracie. What I was doing there was actually dealing with an image. And the sense of building on a kind of worry maybe there. It's what engaging across the stages is about, because at whatever stage of development we happen to be at, forget about ages, you know, we can all identify with that kind of image that's set right before us. And what I want to suggest to you is that when we're trying to engage across the stages, then actually if we can deal with people's imagination, and there's a talk I would use to talk about peace, the peace that God gives us, but it's about presenting images, and we can do that in the way we're leading prayers, we can do it in the way we're giving a message. This is the stuff that we're going to look at in the second session, but it is possible to do it. And in fact, you look at to the world of entertainment and you see it done over and over again. Any of the kind of the films, the Pixar animations, that, you know, Toy Story, that kind of stuff, or The Simpsons, or The Muppets, going back a few years, you know, those are things that actually you can get all different ages watching at the same time, and they'll all be engaged at the same time. The same images that are being put before them will make different people laugh at different things at different points in time. But the point I'm making is there is such a thing as being able to engage everybody simultaneously, wherever we're at in our development. And what I want to suggest to you, and this is what we're going to unpack in the second session, is that the key to doing that, or a key to doing it, is working with the imagination. Working with the imagination, because we're talking about dealing with images in order to connect with people and to allow God to speak to people through those images. A writer called Paul Scott Wilson spoke of the imagination, and he said it's the bringing together of two ideas that might not otherwise be connected and developing the creative energy they generate. He said that by juxtaposing two things with which we may be familiar but which are not usually juxtaposed, something new, fresh and creative is generated. He said Jesus used to do this all the time, and he gives us an example. He says, you know, you've got the image of the camel and the eye of the needle, two images that you wouldn't normally put together. The moment you put those two ideas together, the camel and the eye of the needle, when you put those together in the same sentence, you have two different images to come together and they generate something new and fresh. He says if you're actually going to do this into today's generation, you might want to perhaps not talk about a camel going through an eye of a needle, but you might want to talk about a Mercedes not being able to go through a revolving door. It's about working with the imagination, putting together images and generating new ones. He talks about a school physics lesson where a teacher brought in an old generator where both negative and positive and negative poles had a wire attached. And the ends of the wires were brought closer and closer together. When the ends were 6 inches apart, sparks of electricity jumped through the air. When the ends were 4 inches apart, there was a crackling and a constant spark between them. But when the wires were actually touching, the current simply flowed and there was no visible spark. And thus it is, he says, with the imagination. I quote, "The spark of imagination happens when two ideas that seem to have no apparent connection, poles apart we might say, are brought together. Two conditions are necessary for imagination. One, some connection between the ideas must be possible, and two, the ideas chosen must not be almost identical, for then they would function like the touching wires that had no visible spark." So the imagination, then, it's absolutely vital, vital in connecting with people. The next session, we're going to break for a drink now, but then when we come back together again, we're going to get a bit more practical. And I'm going to share with you some of the ways in which we can engage the imagination. I believe those key ingredients are the use of story, which I've mentioned, using symbol, using a sense of drama in worship, and also a sense of laughter. Laughter and comedy can actually connect with people in such a powerful way. I'm going to take you through in the second session four key aspects of worship. We're going to be thinking about music, about prayer, about giving a message, and about enabling people to make a response. And in all of that, we're going to be thinking about how we might connect with the imagination of people across all the stages. And I'm going to give you some practical ideas that you can do in your own churches. Thank you.